Gill from Perimeter Institute, and he will tell us about the large and limit of tensor models.
So, hello everybody. I would first like to thank the organizers for inviting me to present in this conference. And it's a pleasure for once to have my name pronounced correctly when I get introduced. So, today I'll be telling you about this large and limit of tensor models. And my talk is organized as follows. I start by an introduction and motivation. What are we trying to do with these tensor models? I will then go on defining exactly what I mean by a tensor model. I'll explain the Rovanian expansion, the leading order in this expansion, and finally I'll draw some conclusions. So the main motivation to study tensor models comes from matrix models. So maybe we should review quickly what matrix models are. So what they are a theory of random two-dimensional surfaces. And as such, they've been used in physics in things like the theory of Strong interactions or quantum gravity two-dimension, conformal field theory, and so on. And in mathematics, they've led to a number of developments like free probability theory, some study of invariance of algebraic curves, and so on. So what are matrix models? They are an ab initio combinatorial theory, which generates Feynman graphs, which are ribbon graphs. They are a bit special. And these graphs, they are associated to surfaces. So due to the audience, I'll maybe spend a bit of time explaining exactly how this relation between graphs and surfaces works in matrix models. Now, other features of matrix models, you know, if we consider a theory for a n by n matrix, n, it's an intrinsic parameter. So it acts like a scale from the physicist's point of view. And then these matrix models, they undergo a phase transition or a condensation to a theory of continuous surfaces. If you want a theory of highly refined surfaces. So I start from discretized surfaces, then I take some limit, and I get into a theory of continuous surfaces. Now, all this, you know, usefulness of matrix models relies on what we call the 1 over n expansion in matrix models. So this n, the size of the matrix, the scale, you know, gives us an extra parameter so I can reindex my perturbative series of matrix models as 1 over n expansion, and I can study it order by order. So what is nice is that the perturbative expansion usually in field theory is something which is strongly divergent. And well, if I use this extra parameter in this 1 over n expansion, I get a second development and a second expansion, and this new expansion turns out that the series is manageable, so I can treat it order by order in n. Now, this expansion is dominated by planar graphs, which represent planar surfaces, no? Which is nice. That's the simplest ones we could think of. And well, higher genus surfaces, they come as corrections with this leading order behavior, which is dominated by these planar graphs. So the success of matrix models inspired people to try to generalize them in higher dimensions to theories of random higher dimensional topological spaces. No? So this led to the introduction of tensor models and okay, their close cousins, the group field theories. Now, such models, they generate graphs, you know, as matrix models do, and these graphs, they're this time associated to higher dimensional topological spaces. So up to now, you know, things seem to work out, but unfortunately, the tensor models for a long time have been inaccessible analytically because this 1 over n expansion was lacking. So we could write a theory which generated spaces, you know, random triangulated spaces, but there was no way to control it analytically. So you know, today we can actually understand why it's been so difficult to find this one of an expression, this analytic tool to treat models of random geometry in higher dimensions. And the reason is that, in fact, you know, for matrices, people can either use, have either used Hermitian matrices or arbitrary matrices. Now, the difference are very small between the two cases, you know. And it turns out that Hermitian matrices, they have, you know, real eigenvalues and so on and so forth, so they're a bit nicer to treat. So, no, people naturally in higher dimensions tried to treat tensor models for tensors with some symmetry properties under permutation of indices. Now, whereas in two dimensions, this does not make a big difference. In higher dimensions, it's very risky to do this. You know, what happens is that you generate, because of these symmetry properties, you generate many, many graphs, and their amplitudes are not controllable. Moreover, the topology of the underlying topological space, it's, you know, not nicely encoded. So basically, due to the fact that, you know, we always considered symmetric tensors, we could not do anything with them. So, well, what happens is that instead, if instead of symmetric tensors or tensors with symmetry properties, one chooses just arbitrary tensors with no symmetry properties under permutation of the indices, well, abruptly one gets a lot of, you know, analytical control. So already the graphs, they are, they encode the dimensional spaces and in a very nice way, they encode completely the full cellular structure of a d-dimensional topological space. You know, I'll make a precise statement later. Thus, I really obtain, you know, I can understand this expansion, I can understand these random geometries properly. Then I actually get a 1 over n expansion, meaning that, you know, looking at these graphs generated by tensor models, I can in fact organize them, you know, as leading order graphs and corrections. No? And the leading order sector, it's a summable sector, like the planar graphs are a summable family of graphs. And, well, I just get a phase transition to a continuum. And, well, moreover, tensor models, they have some notions of universality, so, you know, underlying, which arises in the large n limit. Now, today I will try to explain some of these statements. And due to the time constraint, probably I will just explain a bit how these graphs come about in tensor models and how they encode the dimensional spaces. I will explain quickly what I mean by the 1 over n expansion. And well, I'll maybe say one or two words about the leading order graphs, you know, but not very detailed. Good. So before starting what is a relatively technical talk, you know, we should maybe, you know, take a moment to think what we are actually doing. So what happens is that because of these features, tensor models give today an analytically controlled theory for the study of random discretized geometries in arbitrary dimension. So this can be potentially interesting, you know, if we take into account what we did in two dimensions, you know, maybe we can apply it to conformal field theory, integrability, and so on. Good. So one slide review of matrix models. What are matrix models? So matrix models, they are defined, you know, for an n times n matrix by what we call a partition function, which, you know, is this z, which depends on a coupling constant lambda. And well, the partition function, it's an integral over the matrix entries times some, you know, action here with an appropriately chosen scaling. So the action, you know, this object I have here in the exponential, which I try to integrate, it's an invariant defined from the matrix. So it will have some quadratic part, trace them square. And then I have some, you know, invariant perturbations with respect to this Gaussian integral. So this perturbation, well, because they are invariants, they are traces of powers of the matrix. And, you know, just to keep things simple, right now I'll take just this m to the power 3 perturbation. So now the purpose in physics is to try to evaluate this partition function as a function of the coupling constant. And how do we do this? Well, turns out that this partition function can be evaluated in terms of graphs. So if you're not familiar with Feynman graphs, I should maybe say one or two words, you know. So the, my purpose is to calculate something like integral dm exponential minus trace m square plus lambda trace m third. And if you notice there, I put some scaling factor in front, which, you know, for the combinatorial statements I'm going to make is not very important. So for now, I ignore it. Good. So how do I compute such an integral? You know, so this is a perturbed Gaussian integral. You know? So in order to compute it, what I'll be doing, well, I will treat this guy as a small parameter. I will expand in Taylor series for small lambda. So I'll say that z, it's some sum over, you know, the order p, you know. Then I get here exponential minus trace m squared. This is a Gaussian integral. And these guys will now act as insertions. So I'll get here some lambda to the power p times these traces of m cube. Now, this integral, I know how to compute it because it's a Gaussian integral with insertions, you know? So physicists, they use a nice graphical representations to compute such integrals, you know? For each of these insertions here, I will draw what is called a vertex. And because these guys are of degree 3 in the matrix entries, there will be a trivalent vertex. So for each individual here, I will just draw a vertex. So each of these half lines will represent an m, you know? And well, because they are matrices, I'll draw ribbon vertices. You know, matrices have two indices, so I'll associate an index to each of these sides of the ribbon. So here, you know, CA. I will represent such a trace, you know, of m cube by such a drawing, you know. And when I draw something like this, this represents just the, you know, sum over all the indices of MAB, the matrix entries here, MBC, the matrix entries here, MCA, the matrix entry here. So this is a graphical representation of a trace of m cube, you know. Now, because I have several of these guys, you know, I get several insertions in my Gaussian integral, you know, so I get one another here. And how do I evaluate the Gaussian integral? Well, this is easy to compute. It's a sum over contractions. No? So when I evaluate such a Gaussian integral, I just need to pair matrix entries m here with matrix entries m here. You know? So let's say that one of these contractions pairs the matrix entry here with the matrix entry here. You know? And if I look properly and closely at the particular Gaussian measure I have, you know, I see that this pairing identifies indices. So if I had here another matrix with indices b prime, c prime, you know, The quadratic part, the trace of m squared quadratic part, will just identify my indices C and C prime and B and B prime. So this representation, you know, allows me to evaluate the partition function as a sum over ribbon graphs. You know? So the ribbon graphs, well, they have vertices like any graph. They have lines. Well, the fact that they are ribbon graphs gives them some extra structure. Namely, they acquire what we call faces. You know? So when I follow the sides of the ribbons in a graph, I get some two-dimensional patch, which is what we usually call a face. So such a ribbon graph, it's canonically associated to a surface. And how does this association come by? So for every ribbon vertex, which is a trivalent vertex, I'll draw around it a triangle. No? So this, no, I'll even put it on the blackboard. For every vertex, I'll draw around it a dual triangle. And then for every ribbon line, which connects to ribbon vertices, you know, I will glue the triangles dual to the vertices along an edge. So this line here represents just the gluing of these two edges, such that every ribbon graph will now represent, you'll be dual to a gluing of triangles. No? So the vertices, the ribbon vertices represent the triangles. The ribbon line represent the edges. Well, how about these faces? So these faces, which are some two-dimensional patches obtained by going around, you know, on the side of a ribbon, well, it turns out that they are associated to the points. You know? So this face here, you know, which is made by the strands common to these six vertices, it's associated to the point common to the six triangles dual to these guys. No? In this way, every ribbon graph is dual to a surface. But moreover, you know, because the number of ribbon vertices is related to the number of triangles, the number of ribbon lines is related to the number of edges, and the number of faces is related to the number of points, you know, this graph captures, you know, all the cellular structure of the surface. You know, so I know everything about the two cells, which are the triangles, the one cells, which are the edges, and the zero cells, which are the points. You know? Now, starting from this Gaussian integral, I compute. You know, I compute carefully. You know, for every graph, I'll get some specific value of this guy, you know, which is called the amplitude of the graph. You know? So at given contraction scheme, I just evaluate the integral. You know? And turns out that the amplitude of a graph in matrix models has this formula. You know? So this is some coupling constant to the power, the number of ribbon vertices, or the number of triangles. So this is not astonishing, because I say that for each insertion, for each lambda, I draw a triangle. And then, well, I get something which depends on the size of the matrix. So if I chose my scalings well, what I get is the size of the matrix to the power, the Euler character of the surface, which is equal to the Euler character of the graph, because I said that the cellular structure of the surface is completely encoded in the graph. You know? So what I get is that the amplitude of these graphs, which represent discretized surfaces, you know, they go like n to the power 2 minus twice the genus. Good. So what happens is that if I now take the n to infinity limit, instead of getting a sum over all graphs, I just select the planar graphs by this expansion, you know? And the planar graphs, oh, they are much nicer than all the possible graphs, you know? For instance, they form a summable family, you know, with a finite radius of convergence. So when I tune my coupling constant to the radius of convergence of this series, you know, as always, you know, if I approach the analyticity, the boundary of an analyticity domain of a function, I get contributions from higher and higher orders. So it means that when I tune to this critical constant, you know, I get a behavior which is dominated by graphs with many, many vertices, which represent surfaces discretized by many, many triangles. So, you know, like continuous, highly refined surfaces. Now, I can study very closely what happens when I tune to criticality. What turns out is that I obtain a continuum theory, and because two dimensions, you know, are relatively easy to understand, you know, I can identify this continuous theory as a Liouville gravity coupled with conformal matter, meaning what? So this is a theory in which I have some matter fields, but most importantly, I have a fluctuating geometry. So my geometry is a continuum geometry which fluctuates, you know, and this is what I get in the continuum limit of matrix models. So in tensor models, well, what happens is that I can give this, you know, comparison between matrix models and tensor models. I will consider models for one single complex generic tensor, generic meaning with no symmetry properties and the permutation of the indices. So I will write the most general invariant action from such a tensor. So I'll need to discuss a bit the invariance I can build out of a tensor, you know. And it turns out that if I start evaluating such an integral, you know, I will get graphs, like in matrix models. And these graphs, they will be colored graphs, you know, and they will be associated to three-dimensional spaces. Now, for each color graph, I will associate a number, which will be a positive number, which I'll be calling the degree, you know. And well, the degree will play the role of the genus in the 1 over n expansion, meaning that the amplitude of a graph, you know, each graph representing d-dimensional topological space, will be some n to the power, the number of dimensions, minus some suppression in this degree. So if this degree is positive, this is at most nd, and the rest comes as correction. So leading order graphs will be the graphs of degree zero as the graph of genus zero were dominating the matrix models. And in the end, I'll get a phase transition to some continuous theory of fluctuating geometry in higher dimensions. Now, you see here that the degree looks very much like the genus, so you could wonder, is it exactly like the genus? And the answer is no, So except these combinatorial properties of the genus also has another characteristic. It's a topological invariant in two dimensions. This is not true for the degree. So the degree is just a number, which I can compute starting from a particular discretization of a manifold, or actually a pseudo-manifold. But it is not a topological invariant. It combines some topological information with some information about the cellular structure of my particular cellular decomposition. Good. So let's discuss first invariants for tensors. So I will take rank D. So by rank D, I mean that a tensor with D indices, with no symmetry properties under permutation of indices, which transfers under what you call the external tensor product of D fundamental representation of the unitary group of dimension n. Meaning, in equations, they're easier to understand, that under a change of basis, my tensor with D indices, A1 with AD, will change independently on each index. So the first index will transform by a unitary U from B1 to A1. The second index will transform by, with a completely different unitary, which I'll call V, up to the last one, which transforms with a double. So if this is how my tensor T transforms under the change of basis, the complex conjugated tensors, I will just pick up bars all over the place. So these are the transformation properties of my fundamental object, the tensor, and I try to build invariants out of this guy. So a good class of invariants are what we call the trace invariants, which are obtained how? They are obtained by contracting indices, such that the contraction, it's invariant under this unitary transformation. So what does this require? It requires that I always contract a first index A1 with a first index Q1 on a T bar, such that the U here touches the U bar here. So if I look at this contraction, this does not, the value of this guy does not change when I apply an U. So this is an invariant, And turns out that what we call the fundamental theorem of classical invariants of the U-n group, that all invariants can be expressed as linear combination of products of such guys. So they are a particularly nice class of invariants. Like such trace invariants, they can be represented as colored graphs. And how does this representation go? We'll take an example. So consider this invariant. So it's an object which has three tensor entries T and three tensor entries T bar, and the number of contractions. So I will represent every tensor T by a white vertex here, and every tensor T bar by a black vertex. So this white vertex is the corresponds to T A1, A2, C3, and this black vertex here corresponds to T bar P1, P2, P3. Good. So I will then connect these vertices by lines associated to the contractions. Thus, is a contraction here, delta from A1 to P1, will be represented by a line joining the corresponding tensors, This is the tensor having A1, and this is the tensor having B1, And moreover, because I always contract the first index of T with the first index of T bar, I can associate canonically a color to this line, which is the color 1, which signals to me that this contracts the first index of this guy here with the first index of this guy here. So if I take the first three deltas, which identify the first index of T, the second index, and the third index, they are represented as three lines going from T to T bar here. This one goes from T to T bar because I have a delta of A2 to Q2, so this is represented by this line of color 2. And finally, the third one is the delta from A3 to R3, here. So representing all my contractions or my deltas as lines, I end up with such a drawing, and this is, of course, just a choice. I could have very well chosen different contraction schemes, So with six vertices, I can draw several possible terms, several possible graphs. Each of these invariants, has an associated, trace, which will be indexed by the drawing, a trace associated to such a drawing, which will be what? A product of tensor entries for each white vertex and the product of complex conjugated tensor entries for each black vertex. And then for each line, I'll get some identification of indices. So I get one index identification for each of these solid lines here. The one here identifies the first index on this T bar with the first index on this T bar, and so on. So this is how I can represent my invariants. And because they form a basis, I will consider the most general invariant I could write of them and treat it like in matrix models. I will just, try to evaluate a Gaussian integral, a partition function, having here, in the exponent some invariant, an arbitrary invariant. So first of all, in this invariant, I'll be doing the following things. I will separate a quadratic part, because you see that here I treated my matrix model is a perturbed Gaussian, so I will isolate a quadratic part. In this quadratic part, O, it represents the only invariant I can build out of two tensors. You know? So it's associated drawing, it's something like this, you know. I have here a T and a T bar. With indices A and Q, okay, A here, A1 and Q1. And well, the deltas, you know, the contractions, you know, they are just represented by the lines, you know. So this is the only possible invariant I can build with two tensors in which all the indices are contracted, you know, the first one with the first one, the second one with the second one, and so on and so forth. So the quadratic part, you know, the Gaussian part, it's, I put it aside, you know, and all the rest, all the possible invariants, you know, I'll be putting them as perturbations here, you know. I will allow myself maybe to put some scaling with n, where n is the size of an index, you know. So I said that, you know, the tensor transformed under u of n to the external power d, so this is the n here, you know. So I will allow myself to maybe add some scaling in capital N, which is the size, the range of each index, you know, in front of an invariant. Good. Starting from this guy, you know, I will then apply this manipulation and try to evaluate it as a sum over graphs, you know. So what I'll be doing, well, so as I said, I need to expand in this coupling constants TB. So I will need to evaluate Gaussian integrals having this Gaussian part and some insertions which are given by the various trace terms, by the various drawings like this. So each of these drawings here represents one of these insertions, you know. So how to evaluate a Gaussian integral? As I said, the Gaussian integral is a sum over contractions, you know. So expressing my invariants here, you know, as products of T and T bars, you know, a Gaussian integral will just pair T's and T bars in this insertion. So if I have, for instance, a pairing between the T corresponding to this vertex and the T corresponding to this vertex here, T bar, you know, I will relate, I will connect them by a dashed line, which represents a weak contraction, you know. And if I look carefully at this covariance of the Gaussian integral, I see that such a line, you know, a dashed line identifies all the indices. So I see that I have two categories of lines, you know, either solid lines, which identify one index, or these dashed lines, which identify everybody. So this one identifies the index here with the index of this guy here. And this guy identifies one with one prime, two with two prime, and three with three prime. Good. So these are the kind of graphs I get when I evaluate such a, you know, path integral by Feynman graphs, you know. So I will ask myself two questions. So these graphs, you see that they get an extra color, which is this dashed line, you know, which represents the V contractions. So I will first try to understand what is the geometrical interpretation of such a graph having D plus one colors, you know. And then I will try to evaluate their amplitude. No? I told you that these graphs should be associated to topological spaces, and they should support this one over an expansion. So, no, I'll detail this now. Good. So every colored graph, well, is made of two classes of vertices, you know, black and white vertices, which were corresponding to T and T bars, you know. The lines have a color such that every vertex is touched by exactly one line of color one, one line of color two, one line of color three, and one line of color zero. So with these rules, you know, I build a graph, and well, this is the first statement, that every such D plus one color graph is a closed, connected, orientable, d-dimensional, simplicial pseudo-manifold. So does everybody know what a pseudo-manifold is? Short explanation, what's a pseudo-manifold in three dimensions, you know? So it's something which looks mostly like a manifold, you know, like potato, like this, you know? So a manifold is characterized by the fact that for every point, if I look at the neighborhood of the point, what I get, it's a three ball, you know? So the neighborhood of this point is a three ball. Now, a pseudo-manifold has a finite points, which are singular. So if I look at the neighborhood of such a singular point, what I get is a more complicated object. It's a cone over some higher genus surface, you know? So it could be a cone over a donut, or a cone over a, you know, donut with two holes and so on. So every graph like this represents such a pseudo-manifold. So when I evaluate this sum over graphs, I evaluate the sum over all possible discrete pseudo-manifolds. So how can I easily read this pseudo-manifold starting from the graph? Oh, well, so the construction goes, you know, relatively parallel to the one in matrix models. For each vertex now, I will draw around it a simplex. So let's just restrict to 3 plus 1 color. So for each vertex, I'll draw around it a tetrahedron. Now, the lines in my graph will puncture, you know, the triangles which bound this tetrahedron. So the triangles which bound the tetrahedron will inherit the color. So my tetrahedron will be bounded by a triangle of color 3 here and a triangle of color 1 behind, a triangle of color 0 down, and a triangle of color 2, you know, towards the audience. Okay, so now this is about the vertices. The lines, the colored lines in my graph, will represent the unique gluing between tetrahedra, which respects all the colorings. So what does this mean? So because, you know, if I have a line of color 3, you know, and the color 3 is associated to triangles, it will represent the gluing of two tetrahedra along their triangle of color 3. But notice that these initial colors induce colorings on all the lower dimensional cells. For instance, the edge here common to the triangles 1 and 3, it is automatically colored by the colors 1, 3, because it's common to the triangles 1 and 3. So a line of color 3 represents the unique gluing, which not only glues triangle of color 3 on a triangle of color 3, but also it glues the edge of color 1, 3 on the left with the edge of color 1, 3 on the right, and so on and so forth. So a line is the unique gluing which preserves absolutely all the colorings. So because, you know, due to this, you know, I can read off all the cells in my simplicial pseudo-manifold, starting from my graph, and namely, you know, I'll be notably interested in the following by the d minus 2 dimensional cells, so by the one simplicity three dimensions, if you want, which are the edges, which, as I said, are colored by two colors, you know, so they are represented, they are, you know, the line, the edge of color 1, 3, common to the triangles 1, 3, will be represented in a graph as a cycle with colors 1, 3. So if I just read the number of cycles in my graph, I will see how many edges I have in my underlying triangulation of a pseudo-manifold. Good. So two remarks, you know, first, due to a theorem, you know, relatively old theorem, you know, I'm sure that if I generate all the possible colored graphs, I certainly cover all the manifolds, you know. So any d-dimensional, piecewise linear d-dimensional manifold admits a color triangulation exactly, you know, by the rules which I gave on the transparency before. Second, one could ask, okay, so what was one of these tensor invariants representing? So recall that these were the tensor invariants or graph with only three colors, you know, embedded in my graph, which has one extra color due to the dashed lines, you know. So every vertex, I said, you know, when seen as a subgraph of a graph having an extra color, you know, so I have this, well, 1, 2, and 3, and also the zeros. When seen as a subgraph, you know, every graph with colors 1, 2, and 3, you know, will represent, you know, I draw a tetrahedron for each vertex, you know, and well, this pattern here of contraction of indices just represents a pattern of gluing of my tetrahedra along the triangles of colors 1, 2, and 3. So when I glue all these 8 tetrahedra here along the triangles of color 1, 2, and 3, I get up, well, I obtain a chunk, you know, which is something, you know, which has a boundary. The boundary is given by the triangles of color 0, which are not yet glued on anybody. You know? So such an invariant represents just a chunk of space. You know, I avoid to use other names like polytop or whatever because this guy might be singular. You know, a gluing of this tetrahedra might generate a singularity here. So anyways, this gluing of tetrahedra is a chunk. So another way to understand this chunk is the following. Consider the graph and erase the lines of color 0. By the previous theorem, you know, it represents a pseudo-manifold having one less dimension. So if I have three colors, you know, 3 minus 1 makes 2. So a graph with three colors just represents a surface, you know. And, the pseudo-manifolds in two dimensions, they are, you know, surfaces, like either spherical surfaces or donuts. Yes. The point is that, as I told you, each graph has a number of cells. So graph par graph, I can see that I only have a finite number of points around which I might potentially get singularities. Now, then I take n to infinity. So what happens is that this happens in two transparencies. I will see that at the leading order, I only pick up things which are manifolds. Moreover, they are spherical. So getting there. To finish what I was saying here, so each of these drawings with three colors, it's a surface, you know, and when I add the extra color 0 to embed it in a graph with one more color, you know, this just comes to taking the topological cone over this pseudo-manifold, which gives me this chunk, you know. The pseudo-manifold is the surface, you know, triangulated by the red triangles, you know, and if I look at it as a subgraph in a higher dimensional graph, it just represents this topological cone, you know, I cone this surface. Good. So now we get to the 1 over n expansion, you know. So, first of all, you know, a slightly technical transparency, what will replace this genus for the ribbon graph? So what I'll be doing, you know, I'll be trying to count the number of faces, you know, and instead of explaining to you how I count it, I will just state it, you know, the number of faces of a graph, you know. I take a graph having d plus 1 colors and 2p vertices, writes like this, you know. So what is interesting in this formula is that I get some piece which increases with the number of vertices, and then some suppression in this omega, you know. So what is non-trivial in all this statement is that the omega is a positive number. You know? So there exists a positive number such that the total number of faces of my graph evaluates like this. So the idea is, you know, how do I understand this counting? You know, what happens is that because of the colors, I have a lot of structure in my graph. I can identify the faces very well. So what is simpler than these color graphs? Well, are the ribbon graphs I was mentioning before. So what I'm doing first is to identify particular choices of ribbon graphs embedded in my color graphs. You know? So each of these ribbon graphs will have a genus, and the sum of their genera is what I'll be calling the degree. You know? So of course, I can count the number of faces captured by each of these two-dimensional graphs as a function of this genus. And if I do my things properly, you know, I can get the counting of all the faces of the graph. If I chose these ribbon graphs appropriately and I average as I should, you know, and seeing how many times I overcounted faces and so on, I can get certainly a counting of the total number of faces in terms of this genera. Good. So, well, one question would be, you know, what do these jackets represent? You know, they are ribbon graphs, so they represent surfaces. And they are embedded in my higher dimensional graph. So topologically, these are surfaces which are embedded in my, let's say, three-dimensional pseudo-manifold or higher-dimensional pseudo-manifold. So it turns out that they are what we call the Haggard splitting surfaces embedded in my higher-dimensional topological space. Good. So let me give some examples. You know, a simple graph, you know, with four colors, you know, is this graph with two vertices. It's actually the only one I can draw with two vertices, you know. So is degree, well, if I have four colors, I just need to check three of these ribbon graphs, you know, its degree is zero, and its sum over, you know, one of these ribbon graphs has genus zero, the other one genus zero, and the third one genus zero. There are three choices, canonical choices of ribbon graphs I can look. Now, a more complicated example is this one, and turns out that its degree is four. So one of these jackets has genus one genus one, and another one genus two, you know. And, well, this is an even more complicated guy with degree 10, you know, and here I have, you know, the genera of these jackets are four, four, and two. Good. So, how does this degree come into my, you know, 1 over n expansion? So it comes in the following way. I consider my action, and now, because you know what the degree is, I will put a specific scaling for each invariant. So I'll put a small suppression for invariants of higher degree. Now, you should understand that this is just an aesthetical choice, you know. All the results survive, you know. It's just that some, you know, equal signs becomes bounds and so on. So it's a bit nicer to put these scalings, you know. So if I put these scalings, you know, these suppressions of graphs of, you know, higher degree, you know, the amplitude of a graph computes like this, you know, it's an n, the size of the matrix, to the power dimension minus a suppression in the degree. Let me just mention, so as I said, the graphs with three colors, they represent surfaces. So of course, I can compute this degree for graphs with three colors, and well, they represent surfaces, and this degree becomes exactly their genus. No? So it's consistent with the two-dimensional result. So how do I prove this formula? Well, the idea of the proof is the following. I have my complicated graph having this invariants represented by graphs with solid lines connected by these dashed lines. So as I said, each solid line identifies exactly one index, and the dashed lines, well, the dashed lines identify all the indices along them. So, you know, each of these dashed lines identifies everybody. So if I look at the story of one index, what does it do? It's identified once against this solid line, once against this dashed line, once again this solid, once again by this solid line, once by a dashed line, and so on and so forth. So I will identify an index along a cycle with colors 0 and I, along a face with colors 0 and I. So for each of these cycles having colors, let's say 0, 1, 0, 1, you know, I'll get a free sum, so a large factor n. Now, I see that this amplitude has to do with the number of faces of color 0i. Well, I can actually, starting from the counting of all the faces of the graph, I can count only those which contain the color 0, you know. Putting everything together, I get to this formula for the amplitude of a graph. So this is just, you know, start with my Gaussian integral, compute carefully, I get to this. So what is nice about this is that this is at most n to the power d, or suppressed in the degree. So the last thing I'm trying to tell you is, what are the graphs of degree zero, the graphs which dominate this one over an expansion? So we've already seen one, you know, with four colors. It is this guy with two vertices separated by four lines. Now, what does this thing represent topologically? It represents two tetrahedra, which are coherently identified completely along their boundary. So this is just a sphere in three-dimensional sphere. Now, it turns out that all the other graphs of degree zero can be obtained by inserting in this drawing a pair of two vertices connected by three lines, you know, with no matter what colors on the line. So for instance, if I insert on this line of color one here, you know, I get this first contribution. If I insert on the line of color two, I get this graph here. And if I insert on the line of color three, I get this graph here. Or if I insert even on the line of color zero, I get this graph here. So this is a combinatorial statement. Now, in a particular model, when I have particular coupling constants, these graphs will be weighted by this coupling constant. So I need to resum them in some way. Now, what happens is that because I can see them as a process of insertion of this decoration along the lines, they form a summable family, which, you know, I can control analytically like the planar graph. You know? Remark that the first guy was a three-dimensional sphere. So what does a drawing of two vertices connected by three lines represent? So it represents two tetrahedra, which are identified along three triangles, you know, and not the fourth. So this is, you know, like this represents two tetrahedra like this, you know, in which I identify the triangle here of the triangle here, the one behind with the one behind and the one downstairs with the one downstairs, you know. So this just represents a nice ball. So such a graph represents, you know, topologically the coherent insertion of balls into spheres. So it represents a sphere in three dimensions, you know. So they are all spheres, you know, and well, we'll call them melons, you know, because they kind of look like melons. Okay, so this is kind of the end of my story, you know. Starting from this, one can develop the entire machinery, you know, of studying the continuum limit, and we all got some results already. We show that we have a phase transition. We show that, in fact, I get multi-critical points. As a function of the details of the model, I can get various critical exponents. We've studied an Ising model and also dual-weighted models on random lattices in higher dimensions, you know. Yeah, we also studied algebra of constraints. We generalized the loop equations in matrix models, and it turns out to be a more complicated structure, what we call a DRE3 algebra. We also studied some models which are a bit more complicated, namely the quadratic part is not a complete invariant, you know. This equates to taking a field theory with degrees, propagating degrees of freedom, you know. So we have some renormalizable models and so on. And well, just a short list of open questions. Now, the major open question is, okay, we know that we have a continuum phase, which is obtained by tuning to criticality this melonic family, and we try to understand it, you know. We try to control it. We need to know its dimension, the various notion of dimension. So it has topological dimension 4, but what is the spectral dimension of this thing? What is the Hausdorff dimension of this phase, you know? Then we should study also the, you know, the this algebra of constraints, what constraints it imposes on the continuum theory, and so on. So all this, you know, in order to try to make sensible predictions about either conformal field theory or statistical physics in random geometries or even quantum gravity in higher dimensions. So that's it.
Are there any questions, comments?
For the surfaces, which are like strings, the 1 over n corrections represent the splitting of the string. Do you know here the 1 over n corrections, what do they represent?
So the 1 over n expansion, the 1 over n corrections represent what?
The splitting of the strings, on the interaction between strings. So in this case, do you know?
So as far as I know, what they represent, they represent corrections in the sense that I get, you know, if I have, you know, a string propagating from here to here, the leading order is this planar guy, and the second one is the thing with, you know, with some splitting of the string here in two strings. Okay, so I don't have such a nice interpretation of these corrections in 1 over n. I can tell to you, you know, combinatorially what graphs they represent, what kind of surfaces they represent. You know, like these surfaces of higher degrees, I can, you know, order by order understand what they represent. The problem is that what I like mostly, it's a nice continuum theory, you know, like this theory of the string, you know, with a nice semi-classical picture, which tells me what this surface represents for two dimensions. In higher dimensions, I should have some kind of a brain propagating, and this would be some corrections to the propagator of the brain, but, you know, I can't really make a very precise statement about that.
Are there any more questions? Well, if not, then I know we're about 15 minutes behind schedule, but because the cafe is open today, maybe we can try to start again at 1:15. Okay, so let's thank Rezvan again.